The Vermont Conversation with David Goodman. Exploring ideas with innovators, change makers, business leaders, politicians, and activists. A special feature from Vermont Business for Social Responsibility. Underwritten in part by CW Print and Design. Formerly Copy World, your local digital print shop, offering quick design and printing services for projects of all sizes. By Green Mountain Power, partnering with customers on energy transformation while delivering clean, reliable, and cost-effective power. The Alchemist, serving the greater Wataveri community and Vermont since 2003. UVM Medical Center, Burlington, Vermont, the heart and science of medicine. By Concept 2, designers and manufacturers of Concept 2 rowing oars, indoor rower, and ski erg. Proud to support nonprofit groups such as Local Motion, Vermont's statewide nonprofit advocate for walkable and bikeable communities. Let's Grow Kids, focusing on the first years of child development, as well as over 750 VBSR business members who believe that sustainable business practices value people, planet, and profit. Learn more at www.vbsr.org.
Welcome to the Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman. Thanks for listening. This week we are broadcasting live from the UVM Davis Center at the VBSR Annual Spring Conference, which takes place here every year. It is a packed house, many hundreds of people, but more importantly, lots of interesting panels and discussions that are going on a variety of topics. We're going to spend the hour doing kind of a round robin of some of the topics that are being discussed with a variety of the leaders of these conversations. And I'm going to start with Jason Haber, who just finished the keynote address here. Jason is the author of the book, The Business of Good, Social Entrepreneurship and the New Bottom Line. Jason, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Thanks for having me on.
So maybe begin by just telling us a little bit of your background that led you to write about social entrepreneurship.
Sure. Well, I knew nothing about social entrepreneurship when I, you know, a couple of years ago. It started for me back in 2009, really. I was working at a real estate firm at the time, and long story short, it was a large firm in New York, and of all things, Muammar Gaddafi wanted to rent an apartment from me, and I refused to do it, and I made a counterproposal to the Libyan government, and they, you know, told me no thanks. But the company I worked for at the time really wanted me to do the deal, and I felt that there was something larger, a larger purpose to our work. It should be done. It should be considered. And so I had left the firm and started my own, one that had a social sense of social responsibility. And every time we did a deal there, we at my new firm, we funded the construction of a clean water well in the developing world. And as a company, we measured our success by calculating how many lives that we had impacted in the developing world, and company grew from a very, very small, and we ended up selling it 3 years ago. And then afterward, I wanted to write about social entrepreneurship and what I saw as the underpinnings behind it. And in my book, The Business of Good, I call this the Great Convergence, this fusion of a troubled world coming together with a more interconnected one, and that's the fuel behind the growth of social entrepreneurship today in America and abroad as well. And so I sort of put some thoughts together and got a hired a literary agent, and we started pitching this book, and with 23 rejections, and the 24th said yes. So that's what brought me here today.
So what in your background led you to object to the Libyan government showering you with money to rent an apartment?
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to have a moral compass, and I think that you don't check that at the door when you go into work. I think too many people might do that, and they might be they might have it more attuned, that compass, in their personal lives and maybe not in their business and professional ones. I think it's important you keep it always on you. And so even though in 2009, at the height of the recession, when I really could have used a very large check, I felt it was much more important that I keep my compass pointed in the right direction.
Explain what you mean by social entrepreneurship.
Social entrepreneurship is the space between where government can't or won't go, and the private sector hasn't gone. There's a gap that exists, and usually that is defined as spaces where there are social problems, be them climate change, income inequality, healthcare, food, water. I mean, you name it. There is a challenge that the private sector has not met with the market, nonprofits haven't yet addressed, or governments haven't or won't address, and that's where social entrepreneurs exist.
And you talk in your speech about capitalism 1.0 versus capitalism 2.0. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, in the book, I talk about rebooting capitalism, and there have been critics of capitalism in that the system creates a set of winners and a set of losers, and too often the winners are a very, very small few, and the losers are the rest of us. And my idea in creating a new form of capitalism is to create companies that are doing social good, so even as they're making a profit, they're contributing in a positive way, in a beneficial way to society, in a way that creates more winners. And that we can use capitalism as a fulcrum for social change if we're not afraid to take the risk and redo the model, which is it's not an us versus them, it's not a winners versus losers, but to create a model where more people have the opportunity to thrive and social problems get addressed through economic development.
How do you address some of the basic contradictions of capitalism that, in fact, create the problems, the inequality, and the sense that, you know, everyone's in it for themselves and their own gain?
Well, that's what we hope to do with social entrepreneurship, in that it changes the me to we, and that the companies have a vested interest in the success of the curing of a certain social problem. And that the bargain that they make is that in a world with less X or Y, whatever that is, we're all better off for it, and that their mission as a company is going to be to cure X or Y. It is a level shift, but I believe more companies will have no choice but to make that level shift as consumers themselves will demand it. So if your values are not aligned with consumers, and as the millennials get older and start to acquire more and more purchasing power, they're going to require companies to have a certain DNA, have a certain ethos. And if companies don't meet that standard, they're going to be out of business. And so I think consumerism is going, the change in consumerism is going to drive what I think will be a fundamental shift in capitalism.
So you're speaking here at the annual conference of Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility, and one of the things I heard in the Q&A is a high degree of skepticism among the folks involved in social responsible work and whatnot about companies using that label to, in a sense, greenwash. And you actually described getting a call from a company's marketing department that wanted to position themselves as a socially responsible company. Explain what
happened. I thought it was the most ridiculous thing. You know, this company called me up there, so I guess someone had read the book, and so they wanted to get my thoughts on millennials, and I was happy to do it. And during the call, it turned out that the marketing department was looking for a cause for this international conglomerate to be affiliated with. But they didn't have it, and they were just, what would be good? It was basically the pitch. You know, water, food, what? And I was like, you guys have this all backwards. That's not how this goes. You decide that. It's in your DNA, and then you align with customers who share that DNA. When you gin it up from your marketing department, first, it's not authentic. Second, they'll know it's not authentic, and it will fail miserably. That's not social entrepreneurship. That's a great example of a marketing gimmick in a company that doesn't get it, and frankly, despite their size, they probably won't be in business in 10 years from now, because I think consumers will buy from a different company.
To give you an example, you've obviously travel around and see a variety of social entrepreneurial situations up close. Give me an example of one that you think really captures the best of what this offers.
It's a company called D-Lite that I really think is amazing. You know, I didn't talk about this in my talk. We ran out of time. But kerosene lamps in the developing world are a huge problem. First of all, kerosene is expensive, and it's a bad light source. And so what people do is when they want to light their homes at night, they use kerosene, just flammable, whether it's for cooking or for reading. And so a lot of people said, if you're in a mud hut or you're in a straw hut, you'll have, you know, fires, and you're also breathing in dirty smoke. Terrible for you. LED lights, very simple solution. The magic was in the engineering to make them sturdy enough for the developing world, which is one company called D-Lite did a few years back, making them indestructible, make them rechargeable through solar. And it literally will light up the lives for certain people and when they see the difference. What's also interesting is it's the kind of product where there's an immediacy to it. Sometimes in healthcare, you take a pill, you have to wait to see the benefit. With this, you just flip a switch, and immediately you see the benefits that you get. So here was a market that was just waiting to be tapped. Millions of people, bad and expensive light source that's hazardous, new, safe, cheaper, done by a social entrepreneur.
What made this entrepreneur any different than anyone who would go in and try and...
So he worked, the guys worked in aid, they were worked in Benin, and they were... they saw a child burned in a fire, and that was the impetus for change. And what they've done is they've created this new model where they're not just selling, but using microfinance tools like through M-Pesa, creating jobs in the local communities where they get built, where they get sold, where they get repaired. So it's a whole ecosystem that they've created.
You've talked about that corporations have no choice but to embrace social responsibility. Now, in the age of Amazon, where people are in these very impersonal buying settings, they're looking for the lowest price. How does that jibe with what you're saying?
Well, I think that people are always going to be price conscious, and I always tell social entrepreneurs, you don't get a pass. You know, you don't get the ability to say, oh, well, my product's not quite as good, but we're changing the world. It's harder than being an entrepreneur because you have to do both. You have to be price right. It has to be just as good, if not better, and you have as well the social component. You get no passes or breaks from consumers. But the truth is that there are consumers out there, at least 50 million of them in the Lojas consumer cohort.
What is Lojas?
The lifestyles of healthy living and sustainability. So this is a group of consumers that actively seek out companies that are aligned with their values, that don't look at themselves as my purchase, but what's in it for us. They look at it as a collective. It's a totally new kind of consumer that was only defined in 11 years ago. So it's a new group that marketers have been studying and trying to understand their habits because they're very different from other consumer groups. And so there's a market out there, and it's going to grow, and it's going to get bigger, and so companies will have to adapt. Even the Amazons will have to adapt.
And how big is that market right now?
50 million identified.
50 million. So... why?
It's 1 in 6 Americans.
And how much sensitivity is there to just people wanting to get things at the cheapest price, which is what the online shopping...
Yeah, I mean, that's why retailers are struggling so much today. But what are they buying on Amazon? You know, a lot of some of Kind snack bars are available on Amazon. You know, it's not just who's selling it, but what are the products that are being purchased. And if you're a retailer and you're looking, or you have a product you're selling, and selling on Amazon can be beneficial to you too. You're reaching a large audience. But it's what is selling on Amazon, and you're seeing a lot of the Lojas consumers will buy there.
So as you think back to what drove you out of commercial real estate and into...
Well, I'm still there. I'm residential.
A residential real estate. So this is the social responsibility work you're doing then is in addition to your real estate work. Well, how does, for example, real estate figure into this in your world, social responsibility as a business practice?
Like what we've done with the clean water, I think, has been copied now by many other firms and even individuals in the industry, which is great to see. I would like to steal it, take it. I don't care. You know, if you're going to do some good, that's a great thing. So I'm happy to have helped spur that. And there are firms all over the country that have written to me over the years and said, hey, we've adopted this model. It's been really good for business, and we're doing something good. So I'm happy about the way it's sort of grown and spawned into other people all over the country.
You talked about an effort by Goldman Sachs to go into social entrepreneurship that ended up losing money.
Yeah.
And yet people still wanted to give them money to invest. Can you just recap?
Yeah, well,
that?
Goldman had social impact bonds, and their first one lost money. It was to fund a recidivism program in Rikers Island, which, as you may know, the prison in Rikers is rife with problems. And so they did a program in there instead of the city funding it, $10 million program. Goldman Sachs made the investment. They hired the professionals. It was backstopped by Bloomberg Philanthropies. Didn't work. Didn't work. They lost money on it. But investors were calling after reading about it and said, you know what? I'm interested in this. I want to know more about this. And they called up. And Goldman was raising money from investors on a money losing proposition, but the next two were reading programs. One I believe in Chicago and one in Utah, and they both worked. So for these social impact bonds, you may see a bigger future in it. I was just talking to someone after my speech. He just read that Fidelity is now getting social impact bonds, and two other firms too. So it's great to see the growth that you can do good in that arena too.
And is the moral of the story that people were willing to give them money and lose the money, or just, you know, whether or not it worked out didn't matter to them that much?
They believed in what they were trying to do, which is, I think, interesting.
Hmm. Okay. Well, Jason Haber is the author of a new book, The Business of Good, Social Entrepreneurship and the New Bottom Line. He was the keynote speaker at the VBSR conference here, going on all day today at UVM. And I know, Jason, you have to catch a flight back to New York now, so we're going to let you go. And thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's
awesome. Thank you.
We're going to turn now to somebody who has been a guest on the Vermont Conversation before. Dwayne Peterson is one of the co-founders of SunCommon, the solar business, and he's very quickly dialing in to join us here. Dwayne is also a longtime board member of Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility. And Dwayne, welcome back to the Vermont Conversation.
It's great to be back in WBEV.
So you've been wearing a variety of hats over the course of your career, involved with VBSR. What keeps you engaged?
Well, it's an amazingly vibrant and committed values-led business community that we have here in the Shire of Vermont. You know, we're a small state, 600,000 population, maybe 200,000 households, and yet there are 750 values-led businesses who belong to Vermont's Businesses for Social Responsibility. That's kind of amazing. 60% of us are small businesses, 15 employees or fewer, all committed to conducting capitalism in the public interest. And so I've just really enjoyed being a part of this community and contributing to it in any way I can. And it's remarkable to be here for a day-long conference with 350 of us from around the state coming to hear keynote speakers like your former guest, panels and workshops on how to do business well, and it's just these are my people.
I have heard regularly over the years this is the largest statewide business socially responsible business organization in the country. Is that your understanding?
That could well be true.
Which is pretty crazy for Vermont to be largest in anything.
Yeah. Well, it speaks to the vibrancy of the socially responsible business movement here. And someday I'll write the history on it. I've done a little exploration, but I think it's interesting that in the 70s, a whole bunch of folks moved to Vermont because, I don't know, it's God's country. It's the reason that, you know, we all live here. But they were drawn here for a variety of reasons, and a lot of them started businesses. And they brought a kind of ethic, you know, from the 60s, from the 70s, kind of based on the golden rule, treat others as you would have them treat you. And so Ben and Jerry and Jeffrey Hollander and Alan Newman and Will Rapp and just a whole bunch of these kind of business pioneers, well, they didn't start out that way. These were just, you know, mostly dudes back in the day, but just folks who came here to like start a little something, and a bunch of them were just wildly successful.
And just to attach business names to that, Jeffrey Hollander was seventh generation, Alan Newman, Magic Hat. Who else did you mention there?
Will Rapp at Gardner Supply.
Gardner Supply.
Now the nation's largest gardening catalog company, you know, Ben and Jerry's. And And so as those companies scaled, as they got larger, they hired, you know, more and more people who helped develop that values-led business kind of methodology and grew successful businesses. And then a bunch of us kind of peeled off and, you know, started our own things. And so it just helped create this really vibrant ecosystem of values-led business. And now there's hundreds and hundreds of new ventures starting, you know, maybe inspired in some way by those earlier kind of pioneers, and fueled by this really effective organization, VBSR.
So back in the early days of Ben and Jerry, there was the famous slogan as they went head-to-head with Pillsbury, which owned Haagen-Dazs, "What's the doughboy afraid of?" So a couple decades on here, do you think that, the world of traditional corporate business has something to be afraid of from socially responsible businesses?
I think the smart ones are not afraid, but they see the opportunity. So one of our cherished Vermont companies, Vermont Creamery, which makes arguably some of the best cheese on the planet, was recently bought by Land O'Lakes, this giant, you know, Wisconsin dairy. And of course, a lot of us were worried, you know, on one level that another, you know, multinational conglomerate has snatched up another little Vermont company, and what's going to happen. The flip side of that is Land O'Lakes, you know, most of their business is in butter, and they're sort of looking at the future and imagining, you know, where do they want their company to go? And so they are very interested in acquiring and helping grow, you know, top flight companies with wonderful products that appeal to different people than, I don't know, butter. And so we're, you know, we're all on the edge of our chair to see how this turns out. But so far, they want to help Vermont Creamery be even bigger and better than it has been, you know, not coming in and wrecking it, because then what was the point of spending all that money on it? So we're seeing, I think, increasingly some big corporations are thinking about the future or seeing some handwriting on the wall. You know, your question was, are they fearful? I think some of them are hopeful and see opportunity in helping build out some of the beautiful things which Vermont has created.
So on this theme of Vermont companies taking over the world, you are one of the co-founders of SunCommon. Give us a quick update, a one-minute update on what's exciting on the horizon for SunCommon.
Well, so SunCommon, we're only 5 years old, but we quickly grew into Vermont's largest solar business. We provide residential and community and now commercial solar. And I think just bluntly, we're on the right side of history. Given the climate change, given, you know, that we have to leave a lot of these fossilized fuels in the ground, the clean energy revolution is upon us. And so I don't think I'm that smart. I kind of, you know, blundered into this because I saw a need. Vermonters, and now we've expanded into New York, you know, people really want clean energy. They want to turn away from fossil fuels. And, oh, by the way, we save people money. And that turns out to be a pretty attractive, you know, proposition. So demand is high, and we're pedaling as fast as we can to match it.
Okay, well, we'll leave it there. Dwayne Peterson, a co-founder of SunCommon and a longtime board member of Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility, thanks so much for joining us. And we'll be back just after the news with more folks from the BDSR conference going on today at UVF.
The Vermont Conversation with David Goodman, underwritten in part by Green Mountain Power, CW Print and Design, formerly Coffee World, Let's Grow Kids by Concept 2, The Alchemist, UVM Medical Center, as well as over 750 VBSR business members who believe that sustainable business practices value people, planet, and profit.
Welcome back. Welcome back to the Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman. We are reporting live this week from the annual conference of Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility, which is taking place all day at the UVM Davis Center. And we're spending the hour with a variety of the panel leaders and keynote speakers who are addressing a variety of aspects of social responsible business circa 2017. And we're going to start off our second half hour with the leaders of a panel called Social Responsibility 201. We're joined by Paul Dickin, who is a senior consultant with Cope & Associates, and Leah Schultz, who is a UVM SEMBA graduate, and she'll explain what that is in a moment. She's also with Cope & Associates. Paul and Leah, thanks for joining us this week on the Vermont Conversation. Oh, I think they're just calling in here to join us, so they'll be with us in one moment. Okay, sounds like we have Paul on the line here.
Hi.
And we have Leah on the line. So, Paul, let me just start by asking, tell me, what is Cope & Associates, the firm that you're with?
Sure, thank you. So Cope & Associates is a Williston-based organizational development and training firm, which seems like a step removed from corporate social responsibility in the initial thought. But our connection, aside from Leah's background in the SEMBA program and being a millennial, our connection is we come across a lot of clients who have HR and organizational development needs that are around multi-generational issues and communication and trying to marry the needs and desires of such a diverse work group and the spirit of certainly our last two generations.
Can you explain what do you mean by a multi-generational, what are you referring to there?
Sure. So we currently have, for the first time ever, five generations of folks in the workplace at the same time. 2% of folks who grew up through World War II years still remain in the workforce. And then the most current generation, Generation Z or Z, depending on where you're from, is now of age, up to age 21, so that they're entering the workforce.
And Leah, you represent some of this diversity of generations. Tell me a little bit about yourself and your background.
Absolutely. So I am a millennial, and actually millennials as of this year make up the largest portion of the U.S. labor force. So I have come to Cope after graduating from the Sustainable Entrepreneurship MBA program at the University of Vermont. And this program embeds the ideals and the principles of corporate social responsibility into the curriculum. Everything from hands-on experience. I did triple dot bottom line accounting as my first accounting class. So we did a triple bottom line accounting project with a tomato farmer in Mexico.
Explain what you mean by triple bottom line.
So triple bottom line accounting was actually developed by a consultant in 1994. So it's been around for quite a long time, but it's really coming into mainstream business today. So it's the principle that you have not just one financial bottom line, but you also have a social and an environmental bottom line in that you account for the impacts of your business.
Paul, going back to you, how do you counsel firms? You've talked about these diverse workplaces, and the workshop you led was on Corporate Social Responsibility 201. So explain what you mean by the 201 part.
Sure. So in previous iterations, the catalyst for the next cycle, if you will, of corporate social responsibility has come from external. From the initial philanthropic days in the 1900s up to 1950s and a little bit beyond, was then replaced, if you will, in thinking through economic theory. Milton Friedman's idea that for-profit businesses only had one stakeholder, and that was the shareholder. So the profit was the only gold that was legitimately in the marketplace. Government policy came in through 1970s through the EPA and other pieces, so there was an external stimulus. And then most recently, we've had business principles where businesses have sort of regained the mantle and taken forward the idea of corporate social responsibility. So that's what we're currently calling 101, our suggestion, based on much of the research and this idea of convergence of multiple generations and corporate social responsibility, is that the catalyst for the next phase of thinking will come from inside the workplace. That we now have 34%, as Leah said, of employees who are millennials, who not only desire a corporate social responsibility mantra, but they demand it. So from inside businesses, that's the next push that we are suggesting is coming.
What looks different about a business that is following this 201 model, Leah Schultz? What looks different to you about these businesses?
Well, I'm calling in today on a smartphone, and one of the researchers said that if you know what a technology was in the past, then it's something new. For me, in technology, or for a four-year-old today, looking at a smartphone, it uses FaceTime. That's what they experience as a phone. For me, as a millennial, growing up in the 90s and moving into today, I know nothing else. Businesses have always had corporate social responsibility as a framework that is suggested and now moving to required. In our talk this morning, we had a great conversation about what happens when social responsibility becomes average. Where do we go from here? And the keynote speaker this morning said that the next phase, which I agree with, is social entrepreneurship. So it's the idea that you're co-designing with your stakeholders on the ground. I've had the opportunity to do that both in China and in Guatemala in previous work. And what I want to do at Cope & Associates is to extend on that model of doing a deep dive, working with community partners to understand the issues that are facing Vermont companies and Vermont nonprofits to build on the capacity that we have for corporate social responsibility.
Paul Dickin, we're talking right now with Paul Dickin and Leah Schultz, they both with Cope & Associates. Paul, what does it mean to you that a company says or is attempting to be socially responsible?
That's a good question. So the primary lens that we use in the type of work we're in is it's an attempt to improve what it currently does. And typically our invitation is either to look forward in either strategic planning or in team building or in promoting excellence and higher standards within the organization, or it's to look back and take stock of what worked and what didn't work and then make sense of it. So what we see and what we bring in terms of corporate social responsibility is we're paying attention to the workforce, we're paying attention to the consumer demands, and we're trying to filter that in with the organization as co-provider, co-sort of producer of the product, to try to make sense of what does that mean for you within sometimes budgetary constraints, certainly within a cultural space that they're currently operating in, and trying to move from current state to what is aspirational in terms of how they want to engender and celebrate this idea of corporate responsibility.
So let's say you go into a traditional company of some sort. What do you do to change it to this new model?
So we do a variety of things. And the invitation we get can be through many, many doors. Often we get a call about training when the topic is really not about training, because training has a place in time after you've established a context and a reason to want to transfer knowledge and change behavior. So we look at what's currently in place. So we do some cultural analysis, and we look at both the prevalent culture and what we call the shadow culture, that is the unspoken norms of the organization. We try to make sense of them. We give recommendations then back to the organization in a sense of an organizational assessment. What's healthy in place in the organization? What can you capitalize on? And where are those developmental opportunities that you can change from currently either latent potential or possibly even sort of harmful effects of the way you currently do business? And that's true whether the topic is social responsibility or employee morale or this idea of engendering positive conversation across generational workforce.
Leah, you are a recent graduate and probably were shopping around looking for different jobs. So you probably saw a variety of different work settings. I'm only guessing here. So what looked different to you, you know, about different places? What leapt out at you as places that looked like a place that a millennial would want to work, and what kind of turned you off?
We had so many conversations about this throughout the SEMBA program about where we would be most impactful. So we talked about the concept of an entrepreneur and an intrapreneur. And there are certainly peers of mine that have gone in the entrepreneurial route. And there are those that have gone into the intrapreneurial where they're embedded in a company and have, whether that's a sustainably forward-thinking company or one that is has concepts and practices that are from 20 years ago. So it's not necessarily about what the environment looks like, but that you have the support structure and the willingness to change to make an impact.
When you say that seems like a company from 20 years ago, what are the telltale signs to you of some place that's a fossil?
Let's see. I think it's potentially more of a hierarchical, top-down type of management system, somewhere that demands more in-office time, so not such a flexible work environment or telecommuting options. Somewhere that, I don't know. I think I've probably steered away from those companies for the most part in terms of where I've looked for employment. But I will say where I interned as part of the SEMBA program, they were large multinational corporations. And in those large corporations, there was still a sense of that kind of structure and that your project you're working on is socially responsible, but that strategy and that decision-making power lied somewhere else. And that is where the tension lies, is whether you can make an impact where you are.
So when you go in as a younger person to a company that's looking for help to modernize, what's the first thing that you kind of zero in on?
So I think it depends on sort of what the ask is. What I've found a great passion in the work with Cope and Associates is finding individuals that are maybe not in those higher level positions and giving them tools to be able to become entrepreneurs in their own right within their company. So for me, it's finding those people that are willing to learn and embrace change and teaching them about process redesign or pushing a strategic planning CSR-related goal. It's finding people that are excited about those improvements and opportunities and helping to harness that.
Okay. Well, Leah Schultz and Paul Dickin, both from Cope & Associates, I want to thank you for joining us on the Vermont Conversation this week.
Thanks for the opportunity, David. Enjoy.
Thank you.
We're going to turn now in our final segment to some of the leaders of a panel on gender diversity and equity. Michelle Ash is the, founder or co-president of TwinCraft. And we're going to give her just a minute as she's in now. Michelle, are you connected with us now? Okay, great. So what is officially your position at Twin?
My official title is Vice President of Organizational Development and Leadership Development.
Okay. And we are also joined by Lindsay Lathrop from Change the Story. Lindsay and Michelle, welcome to both of you to the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you.
Well, Lindsay, let me have you lead off, because I know that Change the Story has been doing a lot of research and coming up with some interesting and surprising findings. So tell me about some of the latest research that Change the Story has done.
Sure. So over the past 2 years, we've really been delving into Vermont women and the economy. And what we've looked at is, who are Vermont women? What are their wages? Looking at poverty and how having children affects the wage gap. We found that the gender wage gap is 16 cents, so women make 84 cents on every dollar earned by men working full-time. And we also looked at, women business ownership. So what is the cost to Vermont when we aren't having women, open businesses at the same rate as men? And also looked at the fields in which that they're opening businesses and how does that impact their wages? And a shocking statistic, you asked me about surprises, we found is that women-owned businesses on average make 19 cents on every dollar that a male-owned business makes in the state. And so when we saw that, we're like, is it 91? No, it's 19 cents on every dollar. So, and then our last report that just came out in March, we looked at women in positional leadership in Vermont. So across public, private, nonprofit, and Abenaki leaders. And find that, we do well in some areas. In fact, we lead the nation in some regards in terms of congressional. But then when you look at, say, corporate, the top 100 grossing Vermont corporations, 8 are led by women. And that really does parallel what you see in Fortune 500. So clearly more needs to be done.
All right, so let me go back to that 19 cents figure. So just to rephrase that, so 2 companies, one led by a woman, one led by a man. A man will make a dollar on a job. A woman will make 19 cents on a typical job.
You got it, yeah.
What accounts for that? That is a huge disparity.
We want to learn more. I mean, it's very similar to when you look at the gender wage gap, right? And you look at
explain what you mean by the gender wage gap.
Sure. So, the gender wage gap is when you look at full-time earnings for equal, looking at equal work, right? So, that means that women are making 16 cents less on every dollar than a man. So they're making 84 cents. And when you, I think that there's a lot of naysayers out there where they're like, well, what does equal work mean? And, women don't negotiate or whatever. So I think that there's a lot of factors at play here. And what Change the Story has done is we're starting to tell the story from a Vermont lens. There's all this national data, but we wanted to really hone in on Vermont and what's the cost to our economy. And a lot of people, can look at this and say, well, this is a women's issue. It is, and it's not. Like, it's an economic issue. There are economic costs, and we are not having all the talent at our table. We're not investing in women in the same way.
Well, Michelle asked, let me get your insight onto some of this data that we're hearing from Lindsay Lathrop. 8 out of 100 of the top companies in Vermont led by women. What's your explanation for why you think that is?
I think I'm just as curious as Lindsay is. I don't really have an explanation for that. I have theories. I could give you some of my theories.
Sure.
I think that
some of my theories are that it's cultural, that, oftentimes young women don't believe that they can do that kind of work to lead. I think it's more of just a belief system and a confidence and a not believing they can also have a family and become a leader in the company, whereas men don't even question that. They can have a family and become a leader.
So you're putting it on the women, holding themselves back. Isn't there more to it than that?
To a point, I do, which is why I think a lot of the education is educating both men and women, educating everybody that there's that the possibilities are out there and there's and creative ways for doing things. And the reason I theorize that is because I've talked to many women that do believe that.
Do you think there are obstacles to women advancing who do want to advance but find that suddenly doors are closed when they get to the upper echelons of opportunity of business?
Without question. And I can share a personal, I can share a story. With Twincraft. We didn't set out to say we want to actively promote women. What we did is we said we want to value human beings in the company, and women happen to be human beings. And so when we really looked at the culture and we really said, let's look and just observe who's doing what, let's really look for competency, let's remove obstacles to people's personal growth and development. And yes, you know, we're a manufacturing company. We did have what I would call a good old boy network. And the way that we kind of shifted that is we shifted our priorities, and we just started asking different questions and observing and becoming aware of what people were doing, actually doing. And here's what we found. In 4 years, we have promoted 10 new American women between the ages of late 20s and early 50s into leadership roles. These are women that, when we weren't looking through the right lens, we weren't noticing that they were the backbone of the company, and that they weren't asking for raises. They weren't asking for promotions. They were being looked over. And I believe they were being looked over because of, A, their nationality, and, B, because they were women. And so we've been working really, really hard on really looking at what do people contribute to the company and what are their competencies. And what we're finding is women are being promoted, younger people are being promoted, as opposed to you have to be here for so long and, you know, and we're finding that some women, now that the culture is shifting, women are stepping up and saying, you know, I'd really like to have a shot at this. So we have some folks in administration that are actually moving into some leadership positions within the factory that they may not have the resume that, you know, would be perfect for that, but they certainly have the capabilities and the drive and desire, and we've moved 2 women into leadership positions within the factory, and they're succeeding. They're doing great.
So for women who are listening, who are, you know, in business in some fashion, what is your advice to them about how to be noticed, how to become leaders in where they are?
How to become a leader is to be a leader in no matter where you are right now in your job. So no matter what your job is, it's not waiting back and waiting for the opportunity to lead. It's leading in your current role. It's studying what management and leadership is on your own. What books do you read? Who are your mentors? Who are women who you really appreciate their management style, their leadership style? Talk to them. Ask them to mentor you. And start doing it right now. You know, are you the kind of person, if you want to lead, that people come to you for advice? Because they need to come to you for advice in your current role before you're actually moving up into the other role. So these are the types of things that I advise women to do. Start doing it now.
Lindsay Lathrop from Change the Story, you've surveyed lots of women in lots of places. What do you think is key to changing the story?
I think, you know, there's a saying that women are over-mentored and under-sponsored. And I think that, you know, with Michelle sharing that earlier part of the story, what they essentially did is they sponsored women. And what that means is that you go the extra step and you're saying, like, you have, yes, we can give you the resources, but I see your potential and I'm going to vouch for you. And often there's an economic benefit to it. And so I think that we all have the responsibility to really, again, use a new lens. You know, we're talking about using a gender lens. Use a gender lens when you're looking to see what you might be missing, because we all miss a lot of different things, you know. And it's no wonder, like, there's a system at play. It's cultural. And I was just talking to someone earlier here, and, you know, we were talking about, you know, in the 50s or the 80s, like, at least the stuff was a little more blatant. And I'm not saying, like, let's go back to that. But what I'm saying is now it's so sneaky. It's invisible. And so then we just go on our days, and, you know, women are still perceived in certain, you know, they step up and they're seen, you know, aggressive or whatever. There's this whole backlash component. So to just, if you feel that coming up for you, to say, huh, that's interesting. I'm noticing that I'm thinking of this woman as bossy or whatever. Like, I'm just going to sit with that for a moment instead of just letting that moment go by.
Okay. Well, Lindsay Lathrop from Change the Story and Michelle Ash from TwinCraft, thanks to both of you for joining us this week on the Vermont Conversation.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And that does it for this week's Vermont Conversation, broadcasting live from the UVM Davis VVSR annual conference. We'll be back next Wednesday at 1 with another Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman. Thanks for listening.
Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility has presented the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman, exploring ideas with innovators, change makers, business leaders, politicians, and activists. The special feature from VVSR is underwritten in part by Let's Grow Kids, focusing on the first years of child development. The Alchemist, serving the greater Waterbury community and Vermont since 2003. By CW Print and Design, formerly Copy World, your local digital print shop, offering quick design and printing services for projects of all sizes. By Concept 2, designers and manufacturers of Concept 2 rowing oars, indoor rower, and Ski Erg. Proud to support nonprofit groups such as Local Motion, Vermont's statewide nonprofit advocate for walkable and bikeable communities. By Green Mountain Power, partnering with customers on energy transformation while delivering clean, reliable, and cost-effective power. UVM Medical Center, Burlington, Vermont, the heart and science of medicine. As well as over 750 VBSR business members who believe that sustainable business practices value people, planet, and profit. Learn more at www.vbsr.org.